May it please the court. Mr. Kirchner. Your Honor, I represent Kayla Jensen, who was about 3 weeks of age at the time she was removed from her home, along with her parents. Kayla was removed by representatives of the Department of Children and Family Services, who came to her home and said that they did not need a warrant to remove Kayla because they are DCFS. Illinois law statutorily, and the constitutions of both the United States and the state of Illinois, require something more than someone being from DCFS to forcibly remove children from their home. It requires either a pre-deprivation hearing and a warrant of apprehension from the court or exigent emergency circumstances. Those did not exist in this case. All that existed was DCFS saying, we're from DCFS, we don't need a court order.
Well, it was a little more than that. They had a telephone call, and somebody had said that one of the people in the home had inappropriately beaten a child.
Your Honor, that's not factually correct.
It's not?
It is not.
Tell me what's wrong with it.
The circumstances that to which the court is referring are these. In the summer of 2000, more than 7 months earlier, there had been an allegation that Mr. Jensen, no allegation as to the mother of this child.
I didn't say. I said someone in custody of the child, who was carrying custody of the child, had inappropriately beaten the child on another occasion.
The call to which the court is referring was a call made by DCFS, a DCFS worker herself.
Right.
It was a call made by that worker as a result of an allegation that had been made about 7 months earlier in the summer of 2000, alleging that Mr. Jensen had engaged in excessive corporal punishment
right.
of a 13-year-old boy.
Right.
This is a three-week-old infant whose environment, according to the record, whose environment was perfectly healthy. The child was perfectly healthy.
I understand that, but we're talking what the issue I raised was not that they just walked up willy-nilly to a door, pounded on it, and announced they were from DCFS. They had information that one of the people having custody of the three-week-old child had inappropriately beaten a, if I recall correctly, a learning disabled child with a belt and abused him. That's the information they had. Even though it occurred months before, this child was only 3 weeks old, so they went there when they found out. What I'm saying is they didn't just knock at the door. They did have some information that was a predicate for their movement. Whether that information was correct, accurate, or inaccurate was not the issue. The issue was whether they had some reason to do this.
Your Honor, I would differ with the framing of the issue by the court in this regard. The issue is whether or not this child, a three-week-old infant, was in danger.
I wasn't talking about that. I said the issue was whether or not the DCFS people had some information that would indicate that there might be somebody there who was not appropriately taking care of minor children. They had a past inflicted injury on one.
And accepting that point from the court, the appropriate thing for DCFS to then do, accepting that as a starting point, would be to go to the home, observe the child, observe the environment, which by everyone's admission was a perfectly healthy environment, with a perfectly healthy, 3-month-old infant in a perfectly healthy environment, and then leave. Instead, these representatives said, we're from DCFS, we don't need a warrant, and remove the child.
Can you identify any case that is factually analogous to this one, which would have alerted the defendant that their actions were unconstitutional?
Your Honor, I believe as far back as June of 1983, as reflected in the Brokaw decision, that there is sufficient information to have put representatives of the Department of Children and Family Services and law enforcement on notice that the Illinois statutory requirements and the Constitution of the United States and of the State of Illinois require the following things before removal. It requires that there be a danger to the health and safety of the child, and that there be such an urgency in the situation. Brokaw described it as the child's life or limb being in immediate jeopardy, such urgent circumstances that they do not have time to go to the court and ask for a warrant of apprehension.
Assuming everything you say is true, there was a ruling on this matter by an Illinois court, wasn't there?
If the court is referring to the shelter care hearing, uh-huh, and the interlocutory order upon which the DCFS defendants rely, there was such an order.
Why doesn't Rooker-Feldman prevent us from having jurisdiction?
Rooker-Feldman isn't applicable at all for the following reasons. First of all, Rooker-Feldman is premised on the notion that you must use the state court system to appeal a final judgment of a state court rather than coming to the federal court and collaterally attacking that judgment.
It says
the final judgment in this case was in favor of my client.
Right.
The interlocutory order to which they refer was an order from which we were not entitled to appeal, because the final judgment was in our favor. It's fundamental.
You mean you got the child back eventually?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You mean you got the child back?
The child was returned at the shelter care hearing.
Right.
The other thing that the DCFS defendants continually evade in their brief is the fact that even though Mr. Jensen had supervisory orders entered at the shelter care hearing, Kayla, the infant, was returned to her mother as a result of that shelter care hearing. So they cannot come to this court and in good conscience say that the circuit court ordered her removal. That's only partially true.
Well, it allowed only supervised visits from Mr. Jensen. And given that Mr. Jensen is living in the home at the time of the seizure, we can't, you know, say that he was permitted unrestricted visits with her or unrestricted time with the infant.
Well, that's true. The court could not say that. But the inquiry occurs before that. The inquiry in this case occurred on the removal. Was the removal made with, one, probable cause, and two, under circumstances which indicated that the life or limb of this infant was in jeopardy, so as to allow the defendants to take this baby from her mother and her father and her home without having gone to court for a warrant of apprehension? Both federal and state law require reasonable efforts to be made to prevent removal. We're not even at that part of the case yet as to whether or not reasonable efforts were made. The issue here is, was there exigent circumstances as required by Brokaw, the Constitution, and the State of Illinois in order to justify a removal without having gone to court to obtain a warrant of apprehension?
Aren't we at a point where we can say that the court's holding at a minimum establishes that a reasonable person would have thought that their actions in seizing the child was not illegal, given that the court upheld that action?
Your Honor, the court didn't uphold that action. The court said it was inappropriate to have removed this child from the care of her mother. The court also never addressed the order. Court's order is attached to our reply brief.
No,
the court's order never, ever, ever addressed or found that there was probable cause to remove the child. That is simply belied by the face of the order.
Did the court order only supervised visits for Jensen?
For Mr. Jensen? That's correct.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
That's correct. And the child was...
Was he living there at the time, 24 hours a day?
At the time the child was removed, yes.
Okay.
And if I'm understanding what the court is implying, what the court is suggesting that is that if there's an allegation made 7 months earlier about excessive corporal punishment to a 13-year-old, That in and of itself, with nothing more, justified in the face of a perfectly healthy environment and a perfectly healthy infant, the removal without court intervention of that infant from her parents.
As a matter of fact, if I'm reading correctly from the order in your reply brief, there is checked the following: no efforts reasonably could have been made to prevent or eliminate the removal of the minors from the home, in that the DFS became aware of the birth of Carola Jensen on January 20th, and it was insufficient time to additional service. So there you go.
May I respond, notwithstanding
the... Well, that's what the order says, isn't it? You said the court did not address the issue, and they did. That's in the order. Thank you.
You may respond.
Thank you, Your Honor. What I said...
No, he wanted a comment. He made
Oh.
What I said, Your Honor, was that we're not at the point when we're talking about removal of dealing with reasonable efforts as necessary under federal or state law. This is an interlocutory order, and for all the reasons in the brief, Rooker-Feldman doesn't apply.
You could have appealed that state the order, could you?
Under Illinois law, there is a mechanism for permissive interlocutory appeal, which the Illinois Supreme Court and appellate courts have said does not, a failure to have done, does not have any res judicata or estoppel effect.
But you chose to come to the federal court rather than appeal or modify the order, right?
It is a permissive interlocutory appeal for which you must seek leave and for which there's no res judicata or federal estoppel effect.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Kirshner. Ms. Welch.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Mary Welch. I'm here on behalf of the defendants, Ms. Foley, Ms. Forrest, and Ms. Harms. Your Honors, as you know, this is an appeal from a dismissal of a complaint, so it makes sense, I think, to look at the words of the complaint first. And there was not just an allegation that there was harm to this child, to the older child. There was, according to the complaint, the amended complaint, paragraph 11, Ms. Foley reported that Kayla Jensen was at immediate risk of harm as a result of an indicated report. That means that there had been an investigation, and the report was, in fact, indicated. So this had gone far beyond just an allegation. Then, the day that DCFS got this report from Ms. Foley, DCFS immediately went to the home of the plaintiffs to take the child, because any child in the home of a parent, a caretaker who has an indicated report of abuse against them, is at risk of harm. And this, the plaintiff doesn't mention this, but in fact, the abuse indicated report against Mr. Jensen was for beating his developmentally disabled child with a belt for wetting the bed.
Ms. Ross, let me just take you. Rooker-Feldman, mm-hmm. Because the action that's challenged here is not the state court decision, but the seizure of the child, which occurred, outside of the court process, right?
Yes, I believe so. But
so why then should we apply Rooker-Feldman instead of the law of preclusion?
Well, this is either a Rooker-Feldman case or
right.
A preclusion case in Rooker-Feldman clothing. We think, and the district court thought, that this was a Rooker-Feldman case because Rooker-Feldman applies not just to injuries when you're directly attacking the state court judgment, you're injured by the state court judgment, but also findings that are inextricably intertwined with the state court judgment. And here, as the court has indicated, if we look at the state court judgment, it says that there was probable cause to believe, and this is attached to both the village defendant's brief and the reply brief, probable cause to believe that Kayla Jensen is neglected because she has an environment injurious to her welfare by risk of physical harm from both the father, who had an indicated report against him for beating his child, and also because the mother failed to intervene in that beating. So, in fact, the circuit court made findings as to both the father and the mother. And the only reason the child was returned, according to this order, to the mother was that the father was away and could have only supervised visitation because the mother could not be trusted to intervene if this far more vulnerable 3-week-old child was subjected to abuse by the father.
But were the findings in the temporary custody order necessary to the final judgment in the state case?
Well, Your Honor, the problem with abuse proceedings is that they really are sui generis, and they're hard to understand. It's like, if I can compare it to a TRO and a final injunction. When you take the snapshot of the temporary custody hearing, what you're doing is saying, what are the facts at this moment and before? And here, of course, there was no difference in the facts from the time of the removal to the 2 working days later that the temporary custody hearing occurred. The only difference was that the child had been removed, so it was no longer at risk from the father. And as long as the father had only supervised visitation, then the child could be returned to the mother. Because the risk of harm from the mother, according to the circuit court's order, was that she wouldn't intervene if she had failed to intervene.
See, I'm really reading Gerkens literally. And, you know, it sure looks like claim preclusion here.
Well, Your Honor, frankly, I mean, we'd be even happier, I think, to have a claim preclusion decision here, because that would take care of the case on the merits, and there would be dismissal with prejudice. This court could affirm on either ground. The facts are there. It's a question of law. I think, yes, it is just like Donald. It's just like Lossman. When the state court makes a finding of probable cause at a prompt post-deprivation hearing, that extinguishes the claim. That issue, the probable cause issue, has been decided. And plaintiff says that there's no preclusive effect because it's a permissive appeal. But in fact, I went back and read this morning, just before I came here, this citation. I believe it's Craig Ellen. And what the court said in Craig Ellen is not that there's no preclusive effect to not appealing. What it said is there's no preclusive effect to the denial of a 306A appeal. And that's a very different thing. I mean, what happened here is that plaintiff could have appealed, he could have done a petition for appeal under 306 for the temporary custody order. He also could have moved to vacate, either under the ordinary rules that you can move to reconsider any order. But he could have gone in on a 306A appeal, and if it had been denied, there would have been no preclusive effect. But because it wasn't even filed, it became the law of the case, and thus it does have preclusive effect.
Judge Bernthal didn't cite Donald, right?
I'm sorry?
Judge Bernthal didn't cite Donald, did he?
No.
Did you present Donald to him? It seems Donald seems pretty compelling here, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, Donald and Lawson both seem very compelling. I think that the parties had discussed it as Rooker-Feldman, and I think that was just the route that the district court took. As the court knows from reading, almost every single Rooker-Feldman case says, you know, it's really confusing. Is this Rooker-Feldman? Is this preclusion?
But we have a Seventh Circuit case.
I'm sorry, yes.
I mean, Donald is pretty close, right?
Yes. I think Donald...
It's confusing, but at least in this circuit, we've kind of pointed the arrow toward preclusion.
Yes. But I think in subsequent cases, because Donald is a little old, I think subsequent cases...
1988 isn't too old. Maybe to a young person like you, I don't think that's an old case.
Well, relatively, because there's been Durgins and Manley and so many other cases since then that have gone both ways. I think that it might have even called into question. I mean, I even went back and read Rooker and Feldman last night I don't think anyone does anymore, to see, you know, what, and I think maybe, you know, maybe Feldman was a collateral estoppel case, but the Supreme Court, you know, decided not to decide that question. Quickly, with regard, if this case, in our opinion, is a Rooker-Feldman case or a collateral estoppel case in Rooker-Feldman clothing. But even if it's neither, it's certainly because there's been this probable cause finding, that extinguishes any possible claim of either the Fourth Amendment for the infant or the 14th Amendment procedural due process for the plaintiff, for the plaintiff's parents. Also, there's no, as far as I can read the complaint, and as the district court did, there's no shock the conscience fact pled that would rise to the level of a substantive due process claim. And lastly, on qualified immunity, the court indicated that in plaintiff's arguments that it would be impossible, or that it was not clearly established, rather, that every caseworker should know when one parent has been indicated that they must go get a court order. And if this court were to say that when you find out you have an indicated parent, you still have to go get a court order, that would put a lot of children in jeopardy. So, if there are no questions, we ask the court to affirm the judgment in our favor.
Thank you. So, Ms. Kirk, no, your time has expired. You may have 1 minute if you want to rebuttal.
Just on that last point, indicated reports are reports that the department investigates and makes an administrative finding of. Indicated reports are maintained in the state central register for anywhere from 5 to 20 years or more, depending on the nature of the allegation. What counsel just said is if a person ever has an indicated report in their life, any child they subsequently have in their household is subject to immediate removal without court intervention, pre-hearings, or anything, simply because the department, sometime in the last 2 decades, indicated a report against one parent.
Thank you, Ms. Kirchner. Thank you, Ms. Walsh. Well, the case is taken.